From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's no Sacramento baseball team in the major leagues, and the Rivercats have only been here for a few years. So what makes Sacramento a good baseball town? Find out today on Insight. Sacramento's long and interesting baseball history is the subject of a new documentary this week on KVIE, Sacramento's PBS station. On today's Insight, you'll hear in-depth conversation with some of the experts featured on the TV show and archive clips. We'll also take the story up to date with Sacramento baseball writer Marcus Bertone. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. America's oldest game has a surprisingly long and distinguished history in Sacramento. I say surprising, given that the city has no Major League Baseball team and the Sacramento Rivercats AAA team just came here in 2000. A new documentary tells the story of baseball in Sacramento. It first airs this week on KVIE, the city's PBS station. The program is called The Golden Game. On today's Insight, you'll meet some of the baseball fans and experts interviewed for the program. You'll also hear clips, including archive audio. And we'll bring things right up to date with Sacramento baseball writer Marcus Bertone. Let's start, though, with the documentary's producer. He's Brian Shadden, and he's in our studio. Brian, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you.
How can Sacramento be a good baseball town when it's never had a true major league team?
Sacramento has a great baseball history. It's one of these, I didn't know what kind of a great baseball history it had until I started working and started talking with some of these people who know the baseball history here. There's been a lot of firsts of baseball here in Sacramento, and I had no idea. It dates all the way back to the mid-1800s here in Sacramento. We've got really one of the first true baseball teams on the West Coast was in Sacramento. One of the first baseball games played on the West Coast was in Sacramento. There's first after first after first, and it's a neat story.
So was it a stretch pitching this idea for a documentary at KVIE?
No, this is the type of thing that we like to do. I mean, the show that it's going to be on is Viewfinder on this Wednesday, and Viewfinder is really a show about our community, and those stories can range from serious to light, and it's often the best shows that we have are shows that deal with things that people didn't maybe know about the city before, and this is one of those.
Also with us in our studio is Francis Pendleton, who's a baseball historian and a former school teacher. Francis, thanks so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you particularly know a lot about 19th century baseball.
Yes, that's my principal interest. I've been researching a lot of Sacramento's Victorian past,
yes.
Particularly since I got involved with the Old City Cemetery 15, 20 years ago.
Well, how and when did baseball come to Sacramento? Do we know exactly when?
Well, in a way, yes. In November of 1859, there was a notice in the newspaper that a baseball team had been formed. And that's the first notice I've been able to find of such an arrangement.
Was that a professional team in any way?
No. These were clubs. And if you think about it, baseball is the only major sport that talks about clubs. We don't hear about the Raiders Club. We don't hear about the Kings Club.
That's a good
point. But we hear about the Giants Club, a baseball club. And so that's how they started. They were clubs. It was recreation for the young men of the day. And there had been a lot of these back east since the middle 1840s. But I'm pretty sure that the first ones in California didn't occur until late 1859.
Is there a person we can point at as the person who really brought baseball here?
Not really. There is some suggestion that Alexander Cartwright, who has been touted as the man who really invented baseball, not Abner Doubleday, came across the plains in 1849.
Looking for gold.
Yes, headed for California, and that he stopped in Sacramento on the 4th of July and probably played baseball here then. And because there is information that he had one of the balls from his games in New York City with him on the trip overland, and that they periodically stopped and played a ball. But so far, I've not been able to uncover any information as to whether or not he was actually at Sutter's Fort on that date, or that there was a game there. He later, in a few days, he went on to San Francisco, rendezvoused with his brother as planned, and he was quite sick. He was sent off to Hawaii to recover, and he liked it. He stayed there, and that's the end of Cartwright.
At least from
California.
Our point of view.
Yeah, and California.
Yes. Also in our studio is Alan Connor, baseball historian, who is, like Francis has heard in the KVIE documentary. Alan, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
So it could be said that Sacramento had the first organized baseball club on the West Coast?
Well, it could be said. There was a game that was played that Francis will probably talk about later in 1859, and apparently the same day there was a game being played in San Francisco. And Francis has the expertise there. I pick up the sport. I tend to look more into the professional days of baseball, which didn't start in Sacramento until 1886.
Okay. Well, Francis, tell us a bit more about these rival games competing to be the first on the West Coast. Is there a few minutes gain one over the other?
Well, actually, the clubs were announced, one in Sacramento in mid-November, and a couple of weeks later, one was announced in San Francisco. And then in early December, there was another Sacramento club announced, because you can't have a baseball game unless you've got two teams. And then another one rose up somewhere in the Bay Area. And so they didn't start playing until the following February. And Sacramento had a game on February the 22nd, which was a holiday, and so did San Francisco. And I haven't been able to find out exactly when each game started, but the San Francisco game ended in a tie score at the end of ninth inning, and then the players had a bit of argument as to what should they do next. They had the rules, and they each side interpreted it differently. They finally gave up and went off to the nearby pub for the dinner that they had already planned to have after the game. But in Sacramento, the game finished with one team ahead of the other, and so that game was completed according to the rules. And that's why I say that the Sacramento game was the first.
Sounds good to me.
Yes.
Brian, how do you tell the story? Do you have to go all Ken Burns on us?
I did have to go all Ken Burns on us. I won't lie there. We did have to chapter it up in segments, because I went into this knowing that it started from Kevin Nelson's book, the whole idea for the show. This was The Golden Game. He wrote a book that was the history of California baseball. And he did that in a very big book. And so this was a brief history of the Sacramento baseball, just focusing on Sacramento. And that's – even telling that story in a half hour is far too daunting. So we had to break it up in some of the highlights of Sacramento baseball, for sure.
Alan, tell us how professional baseball got started in Sacramento.
Well, baseball, as you know, has been played here since the 1850s. And as things became more competitive people tended to do things like bet on baseball games, of all things. And some of the side betting became serious, and people could see that there's great interest. So it eventually it evolved into not only splitting gate receipts and doing side betting, but, you know, the players themselves actually taking the good players becoming their occupation became just baseball players during the season. They didn't have a second job normally during the season. And also the other piece that had to fall into place was that the teams had to become part of organized baseball. They had to join a national association to be recognized. So you had to have a league and then a team and funds coming in to make it professional. And in California, the first professional league was the California League, which formed in 1883 in the San Francisco Bay Area with the San Francisco and Oakland teams. Sacramento, one of our semi-pro teams up in the mid-1880s, became proficient enough and drew enough fans where in 1886 they were invited to join the league.
Was it a well-compensated job in those days?
During the season, it was a fairly well-compensated job. Of course, after the season, everybody went back to what they normally did, whether that was farmer or working at the hardware store.
Mm-hmm. We're going to hear from an interesting person who's featured in the KVIE documentary about the history of baseball in Sacramento. It's William Shubb. Brian, just tell us very quickly who William Shubb is.
William Shubb is a U.S. District Court judge. And this was one of the things that I found really fascinating about this baseball show, is that the people who have the baseball knowledge in this town are people that you maybe wouldn't suspect. And Judge Shubb knows just about as much about the 42 Solons as anybody I know, and he just happens to be a U.S. District Court judge as well.
Well, here he's talking about the early commercial history of the game in general, but in Sacramento too, and he talks about how beer was an important part of the early history of baseball in Sacramento. Of course, games are played in the hot summer with no air conditioning.
One of the early figures in Sacramento baseball was Edward Cripp. He was associated with the Buffalo Brewing Company. He managed the Gilt Edge baseball team in the California League. When the Pacific Coast League was formed, he was the one that was responsible for building the ballpark at Riverside and Broadway. He picked the location at Riverside and Broadway because it was just outside the city limits. At that time, Broadway was the end of Sacramento as a city. On the other side of Broadway, it was Sacramento County. Edward Cripp didn't want to have to deal with the Sacramento Police Department in connection with this new ballpark he was building. In truth and in fact, it was not just a ballpark. It was a gambling casino. And I think Mr. Cripp was more interested in the gambling aspects of it than he was with the baseball aspects, probably. Whether it was baseball or gambling or dancing or anything else, Edward Cripp had an interest in selling beer. Beer played a big part in the early history of Sacramento baseball.
That's William Shubb on The Golden Game, Baseball in Sacramento. It's a documentary about the history of baseball in Sacramento. Airs this week on KVIE. Now, quite a few baseball teams did play in Sacramento, but the two names that I'm most familiar with are the Senators and the Solons. Francis, which came first?
Actually, the Senators, because Solons is just a shortened form of Senators, probably used by the newspaper people because it would fit better in a headline. And
so it was actually the same team.
Yes, it was the same team. I think the word senator naturally would be an obvious one for Sacramento because of the state legislature. But I have found it used in Sacramento in about 1888, influenced, of course, by teams in Washington, D.C., which were called the Senators. And then the name wasn't used much at all on into the 20th century. And it Solons became the official name of the team in the mid-1930s. I think maybe, Alan, you've got the exact...
Well, that came about 1936 when mm-hmm. the St. Louis Cardinals bought the franchise and made them their top farm club and decided to differentiate between their farm team in Sacramento and the Washington Senators. And they officially changed the name to Solons.
Mm-hmm. And but the use of Senators I've tracked back to about 1912.
Yes.
There were a number of different ownerships of the club in the early part of the 1900s, and so they used different names.
Alan, how big a deal was the Pacific Coast League? How did it compare with the American and National Leagues that were mainly in the East Coast and in the Midwest?
Well, before World War II, the Pacific Coast League was not much of a step down from the two Eastern Leagues, as they called them out here. You had the two East Coast leagues, then your West Coast league, the Pacific Coast League. And a lot of folks played as well. There was the competition was nearly as good, and the compensation for some of the better players was equal to going back east. Tony Freitas, one of our stars here, the star of the 1942 series, made more money by staying in Sacramento. And after World War II, Joe Marty stayed in Sacramento, could have gone back to the Philadelphia Phillies, but his pay was matched by the Solons, and they kept him here.
Why did the two Eastern leagues become the dominant major leagues and not the Western leagues?
Well, it wasn't until after transportation became easier after the war. Most baseball travel up until the 1950s was on the train. So once air travel came in the 1950s, and the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers moved out to the West Coast, it just changed the whole conception of the United States. It became more one United States as opposed to, you know, West Coast and East Coast. And the whole idea of bringing the Pacific Coast League in as a third major league, which had been thought about several times, that died at that time.
Is it fair to say that Sacramento never had a major league team, or would it be more accurate to say that it did have a kind of major league team?
I think you could call some of the early teams kind of a major league team, yes. Yeah.
We're talking about the history of baseball in Sacramento in our studio. Frances Pendleton, who's a baseball historian, especially interested in the 19th century in Sacramento. She's a former school teacher. Alan O'Connor, who's a baseball historian, also with us. And Brian Shadden, who's the producer of The Golden Game. It's a documentary airing this week on KVIE about the history of baseball in Sacramento. On the phone, Lou Coppola, who is a former play-by-play announcer for the Sacramento Solons. He joins us. Lou, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, guys, and enjoyed so much the history passed along by especially Francis and especially Alan. I, too, have been reading many of the publications that went back and covered those early days. John Spaulding's book that's so good,
yes,
along with a gentleman out of Alamo, California, that has 10,000 pieces of collectible memorabilia that's in his home. And I have to tell you, when I saw it at the Oakland Museum, I was so impressed. Having been a youngster in Contra Costa County and seeing my first PCL game in 1937 and later staying 38 to see the San Francisco Seals play well, Bob Joyce to throw a 30-game win season. And players of those early days were, yes, interesting and different, and many of them came from the hometowns right around us here, hired right off the so-called high school ball fields.
Lou, tell us, when did you start doing play-by-play for the Solons?
Well, my play-by-play was in the late 50s. I had done the public address announcing for Fred David and Dave Kelly when I first came to Sacramento, second time I came to Sacramento in 1955. And I continued until about 58, and I really only had one good year, but it was an exciting year because doing the PA system, I got to meet a lot of the PCL players of those late 50s. I'm talking about the not only the Sacramento players that were there, Leo Rigetti, of course, the father of the current Giants pitching coach, along with many other names that are famous. Certainly the most famous that I was able to announce and be a part of was that team that was the Phoenix Giants that first year down in Phoenix when they had Juan Marichal, Jose Pagan, Tommy Haller, Bobby Prescott, and the real slugger, Willie McCovey. I saw a ball hit on a line drive that just kept climbing. I never saw it come down as it went along Riverside Boulevard out to the south. That I'll always remember.
Yes, I can imagine. How many people would go to Solon's games when you were calling them?
Well, it wasn't too bad in 55, 56, up until about 58. 58, 59, and 60 were the tail down because of the influx and what I call the robbery of the West Coast by the Giants, Mr. Stoneham and Mr. O'Malley. They destroyed PCL baseball to the tune like I can't tell you.
Is this the Giants when they were still on the East Coast?
That's right. The New York Giants out of the Polo Grounds, not drawing too well, smothered by all the Yankee titles that had been won in the 30s with the DiMaggio's and the Babe Ruth and the Lou Gehrig's. and all of those good players, Bill Dickey, my favorite catcher of the major leagues. And that really took the punch out because people got so enamored after hearing play-by-play done by people like Dizzy Dean and Buddy Blattner on the Mutual Game of the Day, Al Helfer, who was also a fine announcer. And so they would hear these games from the East Coast for the first time in the 50s, late 40s and early 50s. Then you had even radio guys like Gordon McClendon, who would do wonderful recreations out of Texas, out of Dallas, Texas, of games on the nationally speaking.
What do you mean recreations? What were they
doing? Well, that means very definitely all he had was a teletype that was sent by a AP man who was seated there with a teletype machine, and he was feeding him nothing more than the information of the balls and the strikes, and he would have to figure out how to recreate that.
You couldn't do that nowadays.
Oh, nobody does it anymore.
What did announcers think about it then? Did they think that was okay?
Well, everybody bought it. No one thought any different. And, of course, when you had people like McClendon, there was a wonderful guy out here on the West Coast. I later became owner, I believe, connected with the KYA radio station in San Francisco. He did wonderful recreations. They used all the sound effects. You actually thought you were there. You'd hear the bang of the bat. I have to tell you, one of my good friends who retired after many years at KFBK, the famous Tony Kester, told me that he thought that was hokey, and he kept his thing so simplistic you couldn't believe. He used a stick, and there I have a picture of him in the studio where he used a stick batting, you know, hitting a piece of wood. He would hit his thigh to indicate a catching of the ball by the catcher. The crowd was really never there. I listened to some early games in the late 30s of Tony Kester and talking about the great Cardinal teams of that period.
Yes.
And I would be amazed that it was so sedate. So, football was exciting with Bill Stern and the other good announcers of the networks. And here was Tony out here. The loyal Sacramento fans love Tony.
Yes.
They would stand outside wine stocks or other stores downtown and just listen to the speakers. There were also some places where they would post the scores as games were being played, and people would be surrounding that area. This was popular in the 20s and 30s.
Yes. Well, before we get to the demise of the Solons, let's go back to 1942, which was the high point, I think it would be fair to say, of the Solons. Brian, just tell us who. Just give us a thumbnail sketch of Tony Freitas. We're going to hear from him in a moment, but who was Tony Freitas?
Tony Freitas, as I've come to understand, was really Sacramento's greatest sports figure. It's kind of sad that I'm fairly new into the Sacramento area, and I had never heard of Tony Freitas. The name has just kind of fallen out. And from what I understand, he was just amazing, and he was probably, in today's world, I couldn't imagine how great of a pitcher he would have been. But he was something special.
Alan, why isn't Tony Freitas better known?
Well, because it was a long time ago. Tony started pitching in the 1920s, and he's the all-time winningest left-handed minor leaguer, which is kind of a dubious distinction. But understanding that the Pacific Coast League, while considered a minor league in its day, was nearly a major league, that is kind of lost to time. But Tony did some remarkable things. I mean, he did go and pitch for the Philadelphia Athletics. He struck out Babe Ruth. He struck out Lou Gehrig. He struck out a lot of major leaguers and then chose to come back and play in Sacramento because it was his hometown.
Well, we have a clip of Tony Freitas, and this is, I believe, heard during the Golden Game, the KVIE documentary, yes, where he remembers when Sacramento won its first and only Pacific Coast League pennant.
We went into the final week of the season 2.5 games behind L.A. with the full series of 7 to be played. I pitched the first ball game. We lost, naturally. And we also got beat the next day, which left us 4.5 games behind with 5 to play. Well, that was a little rough, but as luck would have it, we started winning a few ball games and got down to the Saturday game, and I think Gene Lillard hit a home run to win that ball game for us, and then Sunday was when we really had the big crowd out there. I think there was around 11,000 people. As usual, we took the field, and before long, we were behind, trailing in the ball game. And And in the late innings, we start coming back. Mel Serafini hit a home run for us in, I think, the seventh inning, which either tied it or put us one run behind. And we kept coming back. And in the eighth inning, I think we had two or three men on base when Ray Mueller hit one. And that put us out in front, and we went on to win that ballgame. We finally beat him, I think it was 7-5. That left us a half a game behind with one game to go. So yours truly was appointed to pitch that ball game, and as luck would have it, they were Lambs. They were a beaten ball club, and I had no trouble with them, and we went on to beat them 5-1 and get Sacramento's only pennant since they were entered in the Coast League 39 years ago.
That's Tony Freitas, a pitcher for Sacramento. Brian, when was that recorded?
This was 1942, so this was just after the series. This is 39 years after the league was created.
Francis, did you go to Solon's games when you were young?
Well, I didn't move to Sacramento until I was in my early teens. But before that, I lived in San Francisco, and I did see some games, probably some of the same games that Lou saw at Seal Stadium. So I was interested in baseball even as a youngster. There were no menfolk in my family that played it, so I don't know what there was about baseball that appealed to me. But it seems that women for generations now have liked baseball for some reason or another. And then I was in high school in Sacramento. And they would, opening day would be a half a day for the school kids. And I was one of those that insisted upon going to the game. That's what the half day off was for. And so yes. I would go down there. I lived not too far from Edmonds Field anyway.
Alan, Edmonds Field, there was a fire there in 1948 and possibly suspicious. What happened?
Well, the old field was, there was a lot of wood in that field, and people ate peanuts in those days, and people also smoked cigarettes right in the stands. It was a different era, and we all have a mutual friend named Stan Gilliam, who claims that it was his cigarette that fell below the stands and caught fire and just burned Edmonds Field to the ground and made the Solons a road team for the rest of the year, but... I don't know. You'll have to watch on Wednesday night and see if you believe Stan or not.
Lou, do you think there's anything suspicious about the fire?
I don't think so. I think it's one of those myths that come, and it sounds good and reads well in the paper, as columnists will sometimes do, and put in words that don't belong there. No, I think it was just an old ballpark that sooner or later was going to catch fire. But, you know, one of the things that was so nice about baseball in Sacramento, I have to say, is the continued support by the fans from a small market area, a very small market area. It presents a new problem, and one that I think if anybody thinks of Major League Baseball having a place here, they have to question it. And I really mean this sincerely. As an old lover of PCL baseball, which I think is the best baseball I ever saw, besides being able to see Willie Mays and Joe DiMaggio in persona, the idea of the hometown talent picked off many times off a high school field, people like Richie Myers and Johnny Briggs, Ed Fitzgerald from Folsom High School, many of those players in their first years maybe played 1 year of minor league ball and then were immediately brought up and played well and did well and got sold. In those early days of the 20s and 30s, that was the way the local management made some money. You
yes.
know, people like Stan Hack, which you may talk about, out of Sac High, was to get him, the Cubs had to pay $50,000 and throw in another ball player. And he played, Stan did, 16 years at third base for the Cubs, one of the Hall of Famers at third base.
Yes. But,
so go ahead and... let me tell you the final thought that I have as I looked at a picture in that other book by Mr. Dillon. That was another thing called the Solons and Senators. A picture of the crowds lined up on the ball field, the many, many children that Francis talks about, the kids and others behind a rope about 10 to 15 feet in front of the fence out there in left field, all around center field and to right field. And that was considered the bleachers because they had the huge crowd there on opening day in 1948 when they had the new stadium,
yes.
Edmonds Field.
Great. Alan, we've got so many other things to come to. So, Alan, you'll have to wrap up this segment for us. When did the Solons leave Sacramento and why?
Well, Sacramento was always one of the smallest markets, if not the smallest market in the Pacific Coast League. And when the Giants came to Northern California, they took a lot of fans from Northern California into San Francisco and away from some of the suburbs of Sacramento. Also, television started televising games, and they hadn't done that before. So we were not able to compete. They just couldn't bring enough folks into the stands and to pay, to be financially competitive. So at the end of the 1960 season, the team was sold and became the Hawaii Islanders.
On our webpage, capradio.org/insight, there's more of Tony Freitas talking about the 1942 PCL pennant race that Sacramento won. Also some wonderful old photographs, including a picture of Edmunds Field and Stan Hack and others. So again, that's capradio.org/insight.
I think we ought to talk about the Mooring brothers back in
very, very quickly. It's going to have to be quickly. Quick, Lou. Very
yeah,
quick.
Ahead.
You got 1 minute.
You do it. Well, no.
I don't know anything about it.
Well, the Mooring brothers were two fellows from Stockton, and they had the chance to buy the ball club from Charlie Graham and a clothier by the name of Heisman on Main Street. And he bought the club, and they had a fairly good team. And in turn, selling it to the Mooring brothers, it was the best thing for Sacramento because we got a brand-new ballpark in 1924. We also got the first lights and night game played in the minor leagues or the major leagues in 1930 at a cost of $10,000. And many famous people besides Tony Freitas, I'm talking about Dolph Camilli, I'm talking about Merle Haig, all played for this great, great brother act. And they held that for almost 15 years until about 35, in the winter of 35, when Sam Brearden made that great overture and bought for a token the Sacramento area and then continued to send his good ball players out here to play baseball, Walker Cooper, along with later on Pepper Martin. But we also have many other names
yes.
that are big names.
Okay, thanks, Lou. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more about Sacramento's baseball history and the present. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our topic today is baseball in Sacramento. The game has a long history here, and a lot of good players and managers have come from here. A new documentary on KVIE this Wednesday tells the story of the Golden Game, baseball in Sacramento. We've been hearing clips from the show and talking with some of the baseball fans and experts featured on the program. Now we're going to move things into the present day and how baseball is in Sacramento and look also at the influence Sacramento has had on baseball in general. On the phone is Tony Asaro, who is Senior Director of Community Relations for the Sacramento Rivercats. That's the AAA team that came to Sacramento in 2000. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
How did minor league baseball return to Sacramento?
Well, it was kind of exciting. You know, there hadn't been PCL team in California for a long time. The Fresno Grizzlies came in the late 90s, and then two gentlemen, Warren Smith and Bob Heeman, had a vision to bring AAA baseball back to Sacramento. They worked with just an outstanding person in Art Savage, and the three of them made that happen on May 15th, 2000, here in Sacramento, California.
And it's been going pretty well, I think it's fair to say, with big crowds, and also the team has done quite well on the field. But just before our break, Alan O'Connor said that one of the problems that the Solons had was Sacramento is about the smallest market in the PCL, but it's a rather different story now, isn't it?
That's true. We're one of the larger markets, we have led all of minor league baseball, over 175 minor league teams throughout the country for 7 years in attendance, as well as having the highest winning percentage. We are an affiliate of the Oakland A's, and so their ball players come through Sacramento, and we've just had a tremendous run. Five times South Division champions and twice back-to-back Pacific Coast League champions, 2003 and 2004.
Baseball fans like nostalgia. Do the Rivercats draw upon the Solon's history and so on?
Yes, definitely. One of the things that the organization found out, as a young boy, I used to go to the Sacramento Solon games at Edmonds Field. And what this organization found out when they came here to Sacramento is that more than any other PCL team, more than any other minor league team, the fans of Sacramento were very baseball savvy. The first thing that Art did, Art Savage did when he reached out to the community was to go to those former Solons to create a spot in the ballpark called the Solon Club where we could recognize the past and enjoy all of the privileges that these young men have based on their history. So the Johnny Briggses and the Kuno Berrigans and Richie Myers and Sam Kanellis and so many others are here, a part of our organization, a part of fan base here with the Rivercats.
So you saw Solon's games yourself?
I did.
How big a deal was it then?
Oh, it was huge. My back then in the late 50s and up to 1960, through the 50s and the 60s, there wasn't a lot of people in this town who had air conditioning. And so what you would do would be to go down to a Solons game at Edmonds Field, and the Delta Breeze had come through, and it was just, I can remember the first time I walked into that stadium and actually saw the green grass and the color of the dirt and the smell of all those peanuts that were underneath the stands. It was just a great place to be. Buddy Peterson, to watch him and his enthusiasm and excitement each and every day out on the ballpark was an inspiration for me as a young child.
One thing the Rivercats has done is to partner with the city of Sacramento and an organization called Access Leisure to build a park called Independence Field. And joining us in our studio is Steve Hornsey, who's program coordinator for Access Leisure. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jeff.
Tell us about Independence Field. How does Independence Field help disabled kids play baseball? Because that's part of the point.
Okay, well, Rivercats Independence Field brings baseball to kids with disabilities. They have a right to play ball and a love to play ball just like anybody else. And this field allows them the independence to play by themselves, to get on the field, move independently, and catch a few flies and hit the ball a few times.
Specifically, what's different about this field that makes it easier for disabled kids to play?
The field is a fully rubberized field. From the backstop all the way to the outfield fence, it's a smooth rubberized surface that allows wheelchairs and walkers to roll and move freely.
Tony, what's the Rivercats' connection to this?
Well, about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, Mike Ubaldi, myself, Stan Atkinson, Tim Hayes, and many others in this community looked at a way in which we could help to create a field for those with disabilities. There's over 26,000 adults and students in this community with disabilities who should be able to play the same games that each and every one of our children play. We think, the Rivercats ourselves believe, that through playing games is how we teach lessons to our children. And so with the Rotary clubs and businesses and all kinds of entrepreneurs in this community, individuals, we were able to raise $1 million to create this field. Back in the 80s, there were cars blowing up, tires on cars blowing up, bad things that were happening in the industry. Well, we were able to make a good thing happen out of that because we recycled those tires in order to create this field so that these kids, so these adults, so these young people and adults could play on a safe surface.
Steve, how many disabled kids are playing baseball at the field?
Currently in our fall league, we have about 40 kids with disabilities signed up for the league.
And what kind of disabilities?
They have both physically and developmental challenges, things like spinal cord injuries, cerebral palsy, as well as developmental disabilities.
You use a wheelchair yourself. Do you play baseball there?
I sure do.
It's not limited to just baseball and softball, though. Steve can tell you there's other programs that will participate on that field as well, right, Steve?
Absolutely. With the surface being so friendly to people with disabilities, we plan to do programs such as maybe wheelchair football, soccer, things like that as well.
Okay, very good. We're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to bring things up to date, look at how Sacramento is doing today baseball-wise and its impact on the major leagues in recent decades. That means we'll be joined by Sacramento Bee sports columnist Marcus Bertone. He's a baseball author. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Kids are the focus of many advertisers. Next time in Insight, psychologist Susan Lin tells you why the commercializing of kids' lives is a problem and what can be done about it. Also, northern pike are still a problem in Lake Davis. Experts will tell you about plans to poison the water again. We're talking today about Sacramento's long baseball history. There's no major league team here, but it's considered a good baseball town. And that history is told on a new documentary this week on KVIE. It's called The Golden Game. It first airs Wednesday evening. We're going to talk about baseball today in Sacramento and emanating from Sacramento. On the phone is Marcus Bertone. He's a Sacramento Bee sports columnist and a baseball author. Marcus, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
How much talent has Sacramento given Major League Baseball in the last couple of decades?
Well, I think Sacramento is right up there with some, you know, some of the major talent-producing cities. Clearly, we've had our share of excellent major leaguers. Derek Lee comes to mind. You know, tremendous first baseman for the Chicago Cubs, and he's just one of many who've you know, played on the sandlots of Sacramento and gone on to really productive major league careers.
Why do you think there's been so much talent from Sacramento when there's been no major league team here?
Well, I think Sacramento has a long standing tradition of baseball. I think before the Sacramento Kings came along, it was really known as a baseball town. And at one time, you know, we had the Sacramento Solons as a minor league team, and there was also the Sacramento Smokies, a really well known semi-pro team. And you know, because of the weather that we have in Sacramento, and just a large talent pool to choose from, it became over the years a real feeder to the big leagues. And you know, Larry Bo came out of Sacramento and went on to win a World Series with the Philadelphia Phillies, and now he's a big time coach with the New York Yankees. And his nephew Nick Johnson started out with the Yankees, and now he's with the Washington Nationals. He went to McClatchy High School, just graduated from there about 10 years ago. So it's been a real shining point for Sacramento that you know, because of the organized little leagues and because of the favorable weather, that it's been a real nice thing for the city to produce so many players.
You mentioned a coach, and a lot of managers and coaches seem to have come from Sacramento. Would it be fair to say that the biggest, the most important of all has been Dusty Baker?
Clearly, you know, he's had the most notoriety, and also because he had a very, very good professional career, primarily with the Dodgers. But then, because you know he was one of the few African American managers, and he managed with the San Francisco Giants, and he managed for a long time, and he really led the way. And at one time, we had four or five Sacramento-born managers at the same time, Jerry Royster being another, and as I mentioned, Larry Boa before, it was something that you couldn't have predicted, but you just had a generation of players who played in Sacramento, high school prep ball in Sacramento in the 60s, who just turned into really solid professional players, and then had the leadership skills to manage. And Dusty clearly has had the most notoriety. Unfortunately for him, his fortunes he hasn't started so well the last few years with the Chicago Cubs.
And he was just fired.
he was just fine. And unfortunately, you know, he was one of the higher paid managers in the baseball. And so, I look for him to land a high profile job someplace, because he is someone who's very sought after.
Marcus, the Oakland A's are not happy where they are right now with their stadium. They're looking to move somewhere else. Do you think Sacramento could support a Major League Baseball team, and do you think they have any chances of securing the Oakland A's?
Well, Jeffrey, I've sort of been on a one-man campaign to bring the A's to Sacramento. I've been a bit of a Don Quixote on that kiss, and I don't know that I've gotten any traction so far. But, you know, the possibility is out there, I believe, because Sacramento is going to grow exponentially in size and wealth in the next 10 to 20 years. And because the A's are in an area where land is very expensive, the Oakland A's don't have the type of civic support that the Sacramento Kings enjoy, for example. There's no half-cent sales tax on the ballot down here, nor will there ever be for a baseball stadium. And so it's been my contention that if the A's continue to have failures at trying to find a location down here, at some point Sacramento is going to become a viable option, particularly because the Sacramento Rivercats, a AAA team, is the most successful minor league franchise in America, bar none, and it can turn 14,000 people out easily. That if there was a big league club, I'm sure they could grow that audience and make an attractive spot for a major league franchise to move to.
Tony Asaro, I don't know if this is something you can talk about. You're with community relations at the Sacramento Rivercats. Are the Rivercats concerned about the fact that the A's are looking to get a stadium somewhere else? And, or, are the Rivercats hoping that the A's might move to Sacramento?
Well, I don't think they're concerned. They just signed a four-year contract to extend their relationship with the A's. And I think they understand that the A's are... a team that wants to stay in Northern California, and so I think they're just sort of standing back and watching what's happening. I mean, clearly the owner of the Rivercats, Art Savage, has run professional sports teams before, and I think that they're gonna sort of sit back and watch to see what happens with the A's.
Okay. Jeffrey, I would agree 100% with what Marcos just said.
Okay. Can you elaborate at all?
No. I mean, as a longtime Sacramentan, I love Pacific Coast League baseball. I love the opportunity to provide something affordable to families throughout the community. But I think Marcos is right. I think that down the road someday, certainly something like that could happen. At no time do I think that the Sacramento Rivercats feel threatened by the possibility.
Okay. Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, so let's wrap things up by quickly checking in with our guests. Is Sacramento still a good baseball town? There's lots of history. There's lots of good things have happened in the past. Is it still a good baseball town? And we're going to have to do this very quickly. Let's start with Frances Pendleton. Do you still enjoy baseball in Sacramento?
Oh, well, certainly. But I think that a documentary like we're seeing Wednesday night on KVIE should help to inform people that Sacramento is a baseball town and has been for, you know, almost 150 years. So the game has been here and it is still here.
Lou Coppola?
No, I don't think this is a baseball town in the sense that it doesn't have the corporations. And I think the corporations are going to make or break anybody coming to this territory. I compare the 100,000 that came the year of 1960 to watch baseball, 1974, 300,000. In 2000, we had almost 900,000. I think you have to really get some big money to be able to pay for those corporate executive suites. And I also think it's going to be tough to get between 2.5 and 3 million people from the Sacramento area to see baseball. I think it's a real challenge.
And Marcus Breton, setting aside the past, is Sacramento a good baseball town today?
I think it's a great baseball town, and I think think that if you look at a team like the A's, they're very efficient, and they've been able to, they're in the Final Four of baseball, whereas the $200 million a year Yankees are going to be watching the Phillies, and they've done it with relatively few corporate sponsors, and I think that Sacramento would frankly be a more attractive alternative than what they have now. They've been able to do so well with what they have now. I think that in the future, Sacramento could pose could be a really good place for either the A's or some other team.
Okay, and very quickly, Brian Shadden, this documentary is in HD. It's the first for KVIE.
This is the very first HD production for KVIE, and it's a perfect one, too. Baseball looks wonderful in HD. Okay. It'll be on very soon in high definition.
Excellent. Well, thank you all. Our guests in the studio, Steve Hornsey from Access Leisure, Brian Shadden from KVIE, and Francis Pendleton, baseball historian, and on the phone, Lou Coppola and Marcus Bertone. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We'll close today with Take Me Out to the Ballgame, played on piano by a guest you'll hear later this week on Insight. He's Andre Previn. A piece Previn wrote dedicated to painter Wayne Thiebaud gets its world premiere in Sacramento this weekend. On Wednesday's Insight, you'll hear Previn, Thiebaud, and the man who commissioned the piece, Michael Morgan of the Sacramento Philharmonic. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, news on the world. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. Kids are the focus of many advertisers, from cereal to cigarettes. Next time in Insight, psychologist Susan Lynn tells you why this is a problem and what can be done about it. Also, northern pike continue to be a nuisance at Lake Davis. Experts tell you about plans to poison the water again. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.